Thank you, Victor and Gary. Thank you guys for being such wonderful bundles of energy. We begin this morning by remembering the spiritual practice that lies at the center of this exploration of spiritual intelligence, and that is soul, S-O-U-L. Stop, observe, understand, and love. So, as we begin to work with today's idea of spiritual mastery, I hope that you will stop and let go of any preconceptions that you might have about that issue and open to some possible new possibilities, and then to observe. Observe where you are in your life, where you are in the process, and then to understand that we are a process of becoming a clearer reflection of our inner divine nature. And then just give yourself a little love and send a little love out to everybody around. So, in the last 2 weeks, we have explored some of this idea of spiritual intelligence and how we are developing and expressing in terms of self-awareness and in terms of awareness of the world around us. Both are modes of being. And today we're going to look at the third quadrant of what Cindy Wigglesworth defines as spiritual intelligence, and it's an action-oriented quadrant. It's a quadrant all about self-mastery. Now, I am sure you know what a master is when you see one. They're totally at ease using the tools and doing the work of their specialty. KU, up on the hill, gives degrees of master and doctorate for people who do that in the field of their specialty in education. And it's easy to acknowledge a master in the fine arts, especially if you don't feel that you have much talent there. And I was reminded of a story by Jack Reamer, who tells this about Itzhak Perlman, the violinist. And I want to share the story with you. Jack says that on November 18, 1995, Itzhak Perlman, the violinist, came on stage to give a concert at Avery Fisher Hall in the Lincoln Center in New York City. And he says, if you have ever been to a Perlman concert, you know that getting on stage is no small achievement for him. He was stricken as a child with polio. And he has braces on both legs, and he walks with the aid of two crutches. And I've seen him do this. And he walks across the stage one step at a time, painfully and slowly, and yet majestically, until he reaches his chair. And he sits down, he puts his crutches on the floor, he undoes the clasps on his legs, and he tucks one leg under his chair and puts the other leg in front. And then he bends down, he picks up his violin, puts it under his chin, nods at the orchestra conductor, and begins to play. Jack writes that by now the audience is used to this ritual. They sit quietly while he makes his way across the stage to his chair. They remain reverently silent while he undoes the clasps on his legs. And they wait until he is ready to play. But this time, on this night, something went wrong. Just as he finished the first few bars, one of the strings on his violin broke. You could hear it snap. It went off like gunfire across the room. And there was no mistaking what that sound meant. And there was no mistaking what he had to do. We figured he would have to get back up, put the clasps back on, pick up the crutches, limp his way off stage to either find another violin or else to find another string for this one. But he didn't. Instead, he closed his eyes for a moment. And then he signaled the conductor to begin again. And the orchestra began. And he played from where he had left off with three strings. He played, Jack says, with such passion and such power and such purity that we had never heard before. And of course, everyone knows it is impossible to play a symphonic work with only three strings on your violin. Jack knew that. The crowd knew that. But that night, Itzhak Perlman refused to know that. You could see him modulating, changing, recomposing the piece in his head. And at one point, Jack says, it sounded like he was detuning the strings to get new sounds from them that they had never made before. And when he finished, there was an awesome silence in the room. And then people rose and they cheered and they clapped from every corner of the auditorium. They were all on their feet screaming and cheering, doing everything they could to show how much they appreciated what he had done. And he smiled. And he wiped the sweat from his brow. And then he raised his bow and quieted the crowd. And he said, in a quiet, pensive tone, "You know, sometimes it is the artist's task to find out how much music you can still make with what you have left." So perhaps our task in this shaky, fast-paced, changing, bewildering world in which we live is to make music, at first with all that we have, and then, when that is no longer possible, with what we have left. For each one of us have a broken string in our life. Now, we may not be master violinists, but we, I believe, are called here today because we have been asked to become masters of our lives. And in this quadrant of spiritual intelligence, it is all about how we develop spiritual mastery. And there are five skills, as defined by Cindy Wigglesworth, and one of them is the critical skill that uses the other four as ways to empower the actualization of this one critical skill. Now, if you were here 2 weeks ago, you may remember that the critical skill in the very first quadrant was to become aware of that divine presence within us. To become aware of our ego and that divine presence, of both, how we show up. And so it may not surprise you that the critical skill in the third quadrant of action is to allow that divine presence to be in charge, our higher self, to always have our higher self in charge of our life. So the four skills, real quickly, that empower us to do this are commitment to our spiritual growth, and I think that's because you're sitting in those chairs, you are committed, living our purpose and our values, having a sustaining faith, and then fourth, seeking guidance from our higher self. Now, all four of these are important and deserve to be deeply considered, and yet I see all four of them as being maybe a subset of this one primary skill of letting our higher self always be in charge of our life. Keeping our higher self in charge is a decision we make new every day. Every day. And we are constantly being asked to choose which voice we listen to, our ego or our higher self. And in fact, when we are just beginning this skill, we are only aware of our ego self. We operate from this place, and only occasionally are we aware that that ego self might be a little demanding, like that three-year-old child throwing a tantrum, wanting the world to be exactly as he wants it. But once we become aware that this ego lives in a state of constant tantrum, we enter a second stage, a stage where we become unhappy with the way this ego self of ours shows up in the world, and we start learning how to be other than that, how to get in touch with that higher self of ours. And we might even at that point decide to stop, observe, and understand ways in which we can grow our skill to hear that voice of spirit in us. We grow into this skill slowly, step by step, this skill of keeping the higher self in charge of our lives. And every time we hear ourselves behaving unskillfully, we invite that higher self to take over, to help us see things differently. And we know that we are getting a deep understanding of this skill when we find ourselves constantly interrupting that ego and saying, now, wait a minute, and taking that breath and finding a different way to behave in the world. And then when we have gained that self-mastery, it is when we live with our higher self in charge. I'm going to invite Victor to come up and share one of my all-time favorite songs. It's by Daniel Namod, and it is all about this choice of deciding in each moment which voice we listen to. Am I going to listen to the voice of fear, or am I going to listen to the voice of love? He's going to share with us, "Love is My Decision." Victor?
Love is my decision. It's up to me to give of my heart. Love is my decision, and no one else can tell me to start. And once I decide change my mind, God will show me how. Love is my decision, and my decision right here and now. Love is my decision. It's up to me to stand on that bridge, and love is my decision, and no one else can make me forgive. And once I decide to change, show me how. And love is my decision, my decision right here and now. love is my decision. It's up to me to dance down that road. And love is my decision. No one else can lighten my load. And once I decide to change my mind, God will show.
Love is our decision. No one else can tell us to start. But once we decide to change our minds, God will show us how. So love becomes our decision in every moment, right here, right now, in every moment of our lives. You know, it's easy to say that we can decide to change, make a decision, and raise our skill level of letting our higher self be in control. But it's not necessarily so easy to remember in the heat of the moment. You know, my personal spiritual work, A Course in Miracles, says that the only real choice we have is the choice of which voice we listen to. Do we listen to that inner voice of fear, or do we listen to that inner voice of love? Our ego or our higher self? It's especially to make that difficult choice when we are invested in the outcome. Our habitual ego cycle, if you will, is to do a round-robin exercise of thought, emotion, action, thought, emotion, action, without any pause, any break in between. And so as an example, I want to share yesterday, I started to take our dog Maggie for a walk. Now, Maggie regards this as the proper behavior of human beings, to take her for walks. And we started down the street, and our neighbor was planting flowers out front in his front yard, and he had his dog with him, his nice, big, friendly dog. But his dog wasn't on leash. And we started down the street, and all of a sudden there was this dog, and Maggie by me was growled. And the neighbor was oblivious because he had his headphones on and his music going, and he had his head down doing the flowers. And I went through this thought pattern. Thought, how stupid to let that dog run free. And emotion, fear, panic, grab the dog. Action, grab Maggie, hold her by my side, wait and see if I'm going to be attacked. Thought, how stupid, how I made this judgment, how stupid, how careless for my neighbor, and how careful I have to be. All of that in a split second. And none of it necessarily aligned with reality. Okay? So in her book, SQ21, Cindy Wigglesworth offers us a technique that she calls reframing to help us make this critical choice. She says the term reframing comes from psychology, and it is a metaphor for how we can reframe a situation. So, none of us want to be wrong or seen in less than a flattering light, right? And our habitual human behavior is to tell ourselves a story that makes us right, a story that puts us in the good light, even if it doesn't align with what happened or what is going on in the moment. But it gives meaning to our lives, the meaning we want it to make. Now, Cindy writes this, and I want to share because this is a really important idea. She says, The ego oversimplifies, overdramatizes, and interprets things in order to keep us safe, i.e., without blame. So the problem is that when we assign blame, not only are we potentially inaccurate, but we are also giving away our power. For instance, it is his fault, quote unquote, that the kids are sad. And the implied solution then is for him to change who he is, become the kind of person I want him to be, and to be the kind of dad that I want him to be. And then the kids will be happy. So there are all kinds of interpretations that we are making. And she says, why does this matter? Because once we own that we are making the interpretations, we can choose a new interpretation. We can reframe the choice, see with new eyes, see things differently. And in that choice, she says, lies tremendous power. So Cindy invites us to reframe the story we tell ourselves. And in that process, we create an alternative story that helps us see the situation differently. Now, I would return us to my yesterday experience of walking Maggie. And if I was to reframe this story, Cindy says, first, let me let my ego voice make full noise. So, for instance, I might say, why me? This kind of inconsiderate behavior is always happening to me. Or, I'm going to sue. If that dog makes any kind of attack at Maggie, I'm going to call a lawyer. Or, oh, super, super. If Maggie gets bit, I'll have to take her to the vets. And then I won't have time to finish my talk for tomorrow. And I'll have people thinking I'm incompetent. And, oh, what a lousy week. And you get the idea. You can make it as dramatic and melodramatic as possible. And if we then invite our higher self to find a more compassionate way to tell the story, I might quietly just invite my ego to take a rest and take that breath to stop and observe, oh, the dog is standing there. It's wagging its tail. You know, they might even be happy to see us. Or, our neighbor has such a lovely yard filled with all types of flowers. It is a pleasure to walk by every single day. Or, I am grateful that I can take Maggie for a walk. It does her good. It does me good. In fact, stopping long enough to let Maggie regain her breath is a blessing to both of us. Two very different outcomes, two very different stories, all about the same incident. And all because ego was driving one and my higher self was inviting me into another. Once we tell ourselves a new story from that higher self, we can compare what emotions we felt with the two perspectives. And the insight that we gain helps us choose which voice we want to listen to. Sometimes in our life, one of our violin strings breaks. And in that moment, we have to choose how we will respond. And if we choose to decide with those decisions of self-mastery, to listen to the voice of our higher self, to let our higher self lead the way, to be in charge of our life. It is possible that even with three strings, we might make some beautiful music. So take a breath. And I'm going to invite Victor to come up, and he's going to lead us in a chant as we prepare ourselves for meditation.